Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock. Another beautiful night in the Chicago area. Glad to be broadcasting this all-star break. Less baseball, more Extension 720. We had a whole show planned, but we're just going to go wall-to-wall alligator. It's not surprising to me that an alligator living in the Humboldt Park Lagoon.
Well, reports it is now riding an electric scooter on the 606. So,
Jen DeSalvo's here. She's got Alligator Watch 24/7.
I'm going to try to do my best here.
Remember Gawker, the famed media company that is now no longer. They used to have Gawker Stalker, where they would stalk celebrities. And we should do Alligator Stalker or something. Extension 720 Alligator Stalker and just have little spots in the lagoon where it's at.
Sounds good. And just so we don't get called fake news, it is not on the 606. It is still in the lagoon. It's still swimming.
Thank you for that clarification.
You're welcome.
We'll come back to you on the hour, every minute, every second. Dun, dun, dun. Alligator watch. If you're just tuning in, there's an alligator in the lagoon. That's all I got.
Is Duffy still here? Can we get an official
he's working on it.
Tag.
He's in his studio. Or better known as a cave, no windows, making sure that the alligator sound effects are ready. All right, let's get to it. Tonight we got a great show lined up. We are actually going to talk about the pursuit of the good life. Professor Al Genie's here tonight. Our resident philosopher is going to join us in the 8 o'clock hour to talk about three philosophers throughout history, different generations, different time periods, who philosophized about the pursuit of the good life and what that means. And we're all kind of striving to be better, and we're also striving to live that good life, whatever that means to you and to me and everyone else in between. So let's kind of bat that around. I'm excited to talk about what is the good life, and also what's the pursuit, and of course, what are some of the pitfalls and roadblocks when someone is over pursuing the good life. We'll have that conversation coming up at 8 o'clock. Always good to have the professor here. When we were doing the download, he came on every month. Now, we're preempted so many times that I feel like we don't get that chance. But lucky to have him tonight here on Extension 720. Coming up, all of our stories tonight kind of surround the theme of the good life. We'll talk about the pursuit of the good life. Coming up in the 7:30 segment, we'll talk about a restaurant club that has been pursuing the good life for 20 years. 1,000 restaurants. They just hit the 1,000 restaurant mark. Can you believe that, Jen? A restaurant club that has made 1,000 restaurant appearances.
Wow.
Have you ever belonged to a...
That's so cute, no.
Pete Zimmerman has, because I've known Pete for a while now, and I know that you were really trying to get your restaurant club going.
Yeah, the Gastronauts, we were called.
Oh.
We had T-shirts.
Wow.
It was a thing.
Did you get to 1,000?
I got up to about 30.
No, that's good. 30's not bad at all. That's a valiant effort.
Yeah. I don't know how that... I want to find out how they do it, because once you get to be a grown-up with responsibilities, because we were pretty solid. But the thing is, I lived in Rogers Park. The other people lived in Edgewater. The other people lived in Andersonville. We all kind of lived around, and one couple moved to Portage Park, and they always wanted to pick restaurants where they lived. We never wanted to go that far. So it all just kind of fell apart.
It became everybody took a stand.
Right.
If it's not in my neighborhood, I'm out.
I'm like, oh, I'll just go to Hopleaf.
Why don't we start this? Because one of the things I've been wanting to do is try at least a restaurant in every single neighborhood of the city.
I think it would be great. I think it'd be really fun to do a restaurant club for Extension 720 listeners, where everyone, and you could follow what it's called, Restaurant Club. They have a website, restaurantclub.com, but we'll find out their secret to their success, but it seems to be its organization. From the get-go, they recognized that the power was in how organized they were with a large group of people, a group that grew and grew and grew over time. But to get to 20 years and 1,000 restaurants, I don't even know how that's possible. But we'll talk to them, went out and visited their 1,000th party, if you will, and we'll report back on that coming up in the 7:30 hour. Also, singer-songwriter and producer Mr. Hudson, he produced some tremendous, tremendous music, 808s and Heartbreak, the Kanye West album, as well as doing a lot of great stuff with Jay-Z, the song Young Forever. That's his voice. He is in town. He's got a new album. He's going to be in studio, but we'll talk about Good Life makes a lot of sense. You know, he produced for Kanye West, Good Life, the song. A lot of opportunities there to do some wordplay with him, but we'll talk with the Birmingham English born producer, singer, songwriter Mr. Hudson coming up on the program. And we'll go out to Logan Square as well. Logan Square, the site of the bar Kohl's is a quintessential Chicago dive bar, living the good life for 10 years now and celebrated its 10th year anniversary. We'll talk with the owner Coleman about how he does it in a gentrifying neighborhood. How does he keep his dive bar business going when everybody wants that storefront, everybody wants a piece of Milwaukee Avenue? We'll talk about that coming up a little bit later in the show. All that's coming up on Extension 720 tonight. Pete Zimmerman's here, Jen DeSalvo as well. I'm Justin Kaufman, and we will get to it right after the break, so stay with us. Texter just texted in. Mike texted in, does Jussie Smollett have a new alligator movie coming out? Maybe this is just a play for free publicity. There is an alligator movie coming out this weekend. It's called Crawl. You may have seen the billboards for it. I just looked it up. It comes out on July 12th. So, yeah, possibly. You know, they'll get there, all that work, to get to a billboard, a floating billboard that's in the Humboldt Park Lagoon. Maybe it's not a real alligator. Maybe it's a promotional item for a movie. Something to think about. Although the police department has confirmed it's an alligator. But it could be a well-trained alligator. You never know. You know, it's Hollywood. They could be like, listen, it can't be a fake alligator. They'll suss that out. How about a real alligator that can talk, that can say July 12th? So when they get close to getting the alligator out of the lagoon, it'll go July 12th, see, crawl. Something to think about. You'd think that I would not put it past Hollywood. Yeah, get in the net. Only if you go see Crawl on July 12th. Voiced by Jussie Smollett. He's the voice. 219 says it doesn't look real, it's fake. So maybe there is a little stunt. Maybe it's a Hollywood stunt gone awry. Or probably more likely an alligator that grew too big for the bathtub of some idiot who's like, oh, I want an alligator as a pet. Oh, this guy thing got big. I need to get rid of it. And I only know one source of water, and that's really close to my house. I don't want to call anybody. It's a lot of work. It's not even about getting in trouble. It's just a ton of work, and this thing bites. So if we can just get it to that pond, about a block from my house, that would be great. Ouch, ouch, ouch. Keeps trying to bite me. I don't know what the water temperature would be for the Humboldt Park Lagoon. I know that, you know, the lake is obviously cold. I don't think that alligators do well in the cold. Maybe, what do I know? I'm just getting an alligator specialist on the horn. Or not. Again, I don't even know why we're talking about this. Let's talk about the All-Star Game, which, according to Twitter, I'm not watching the All-Star Game. I've said this before, Pete. I love the recaps that they do for rain delays for the All-Star Games, where they do the 1983 All-Star Game, 1979 All-Star Game. I don't actually like the actual All-Star Game.
Yeah.
Watching the game is, you would think it'd be much more exciting, but instead it's really good pitchers and a lot of strikeouts. I think they went 1-2-3 Javi Baez. I didn't see what happened, but he didn't get on base.
Yeah, I had him monitoring, and I saw him up with a 3-2 count, and then I lost.
Then you looked, and it's a commercial for...
They're thinking about Gators.
It's a commercial for Crawl. In the Gator movie. But according to Twitter, that when they were introduced, when the players were introduced, the three Cubs players, which would be Javi Baez, Wilson Contreras, and Chris Bryant, were booed by the Cleveland audience because the Cleveland, of course, they lost in the World Series. But that was almost 3 years ago now.
Never forget.
I'm trying to think, like, when Indianapolis Colts get introduced in Chicago, we're like, boo, because they beat the Bears in 2007. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if that, or an Indians fan, I'd move on. You've had many opportunities since 2 years of playoffs that you got bounced. So does that mean that you also boo all the Yankees and you boo all the Astros? I'm sure they do, but it's pretty exhausting. So much booing if you're the Cleveland Indian fan. Oh, that team beat us. Boo. Oh, that team beat us. Oh, that team beat us. They all beat us. Boo. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I want to see clips, highlights.
Yeah, right. They should package quickly a Mel Allen type thing right away, right? Like, that should be some social media producer's job. To almost put a filter on highlights, but make it very 1970s film-like. Dent, 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 dent.
When we were in Detroit, we went to the Detroit Institute of Art, really nice museum up in Detroit. And I was kind of dragging my feet, as I sometimes do when we head to a museum. But we get in the lobby and there's this big thing, big banner that says, you know, from baseball from beginning to 2019. I'm like, all right. All right, right up my alley. And they had a baseball exhibit with like old baseball cards and like funny stories and like a pack of cigarettes that they used to give. You buy a pack of cigarettes a baseball card would come with it, an old pack of cigarettes. But then they had this like old TV that was playing highlights of the 1984 World Series
Jack Morris. Yep.
Yeah.
Great.
Kirk Gibson comes to the plate. And they had like the you could hear the audio of Dick Williams going to Goose Gossage.
Let's bring in the goose. Big mustaches, lots of chew in the mouth.
Goose Gossage wanted to pitch to Gibson, and Dick Williams wanted to walk him, but then Kirk got Gossage convinced him to pitch to Gibson, then Gibson hit a home run.
How long did you stay in front of the TV Molly moved on, and she's like, get over here, and you're like, I got to finish this.
It was a three-minute loop. I watched it four times. It was so fun.
That's great. Those are the best. There's a Chicago, I know there's a Chicago Sports Hall of Fame here. And I'm thinking about, because when we went to Pittsburgh, you and I had the same experience. You go to the Pittsburgh History Museum and they have a whole area of the We Are Family Pittsburgh Pirates. Yeah. But then they also have the Immaculate Reception with Franco Harris. And they have a bunch of those videos on the loop and that kind of stuff to watch. And I was thinking in my head, I'm like, I don't know if there's a place in Chicago that does that for all, like for Jordan or for the 85 Bears. Is there, when you go to the Field Museum, are they showing sports history? You go to the History Museum, do they show sports history? I'm not even sure they do at the Chicago History Museum. I haven't been there in a while. I remember the last time I went, there was so many references to the word Pritzker. Yeah, it was just, okay, the Pritzker this, so. Pritzker that. There was a point where in the Chicago History Museum, there's a wall that is the family tree of the Pritzkers. You're like, so that's on the wall, but there's no three-minute loop of the 84 Cubs or the 89 Cubs or the 85 Bears or the 90s Bulls, right?
That's bad curation.
Yeah. I'm glad that I now know what Gigi's relationship is to JB. And the little redhead cousin that sits front, courtside at Bulls games. I'm glad I got that all figured out. But I'd much rather see the three-minute loop of Mel Allen doing the 1996 Bulls, right?
I remember when we were at that museum in Pittsburgh, too. It's great. Yeah, you see all the Steeler stuff, the Pirates, just a lot of great stuff. But then for some reason, I get caught in the high school, Western Pennsylvania high school sports. For like 10 minutes, I'm looking at this. I'm like, oh, wow, they look good. Wow, it's a quality team.
The quality team. These juniors can play.
Yeah, like, what am I doing?
That's hilarious. That was the part where you went up the stairs and like, I sussed that out. I'm like, nah, I'm going to the catch-up exhibit. You can move on with the Western Pennsylvania High School. I'll go to the ketchup exhibit.
I was up there because I was waiting, because you know how they had that thing where you could throw the football? And I was waiting because I wanted to throw the football, but like kids were in the line.
That's how they get you. They get you where they're like, we know that the tourists want to throw the football, so they're gonna sit through the Western Pennsylvania High School exhibit. That's great. All right, coming up, we'll talk about the 20th anniversary of Restaurant Club, 1,000 restaurants, and also Professor Al Genie coming in studio to talk about the pursuit of the good life. It's Extension 720. Stay with us. Welcome back to Extension 720 on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Tonight, we examine the good life, or at least the pursuit of the good life. Our resident philosopher Al Genie will be here in a bit to talk about how we usually go wrong in that pursuit. But first, when pursuing the good life, any combination would have to include the four F's: friends, family, fun, and, well, food. All those categories are covered in this next story about a restaurant club, not just any old restaurant club, a club that is celebrating its 20th anniversary and 1,000 restaurants. Restaurant Club is the product of friends who met at Kalamazoo College in the 90s. They moved to Chicago, and instead of drifting apart, decided to start, well, a restaurant club. Every Friday, a member would pick a spot and the group would convene. I met up with some of the members at their big 20th anniversary celebration at an event space on the Near West Side. One of the founders is Matt Priest.
First few years we lived in Chicago, we found ourselves going to the same burrito joints over and over again. I mean, we were just out of college and we were having fun, but we sort of realized that we were kind of, if you're going to live in Chicago, it's a waste, you know, to just go to the same five restaurants in your neighborhood all the time. So in the beginning, it was, the main point was just to get out, see some neighborhoods, try some different types of food, and just sort of take fuller advantage of the city. And then I think over time, even though it's still about that sometimes, it became a little bit more about a way to keep in touch and hang out with old friends, you know, as it got harder and folks got more jobs that were more serious and kids and...
What's the biggest challenge about Restaurant Club?
You know, everyone had different things they wanted out of Restaurant Club. And in the beginning, everybody was kind of on the same page. But over time, some folks moved a little further from the city. They had kids. They had they were not able to get out as often. And so at a certain point, I think some people sort of felt like, if I only have one night out every couple months, I really want to make sure it's going to be a place that I know is gonna be good.
Quality control.
I want to know who's going to be there. But in the beginning, it was just like whoever, wherever, and we would go to restaurants that were terrible, and sometimes that was fun, you know. But as it went on, and I think there are still some folks in the group who still really like the adventurous aspects of it, and then there's other folks who really use it as a way to see old friends. And so that's the toughest part, probably, just balancing what everybody wants out of it, which is real different things.
It's one thing to start a restaurant club, but it's another to maintain one. This one in particular has grown over the years, and as friends brought friends and word of mouth spread, the group grew. To date, there are over 200 members. From spreadsheets to websites to regular assignments, this became almost like a second job, a fun second job. Elizabeth Lindau was there at the beginning.
I think it was just like as people were young and, you know, people's friends networks were still sort of forming, and new people would sort of come and go a little bit, but it was a way to like stay in touch with your friends and like... just connect, and it's a little bit, there's an element of randomness to it, you know, like you didn't know who would be there necessarily, or it'd be different people every week, so I don't know, it just helped our friend networks as you were, you know, getting started and moving to the city.
This is, you know, you talk about 1,000 restaurants. That's a lot of restaurants. When you think about that and think about the restaurant club that you've been a part of, it's almost unfathomable.
Yeah, and from about, someone knows the answer, a long number of years, you could not repeat restaurants. So for well over a decade, I think, we never went to the same restaurant twice. Eventually, people said, okay, you know, it's been like 700 weeks, let's repeat. So now we do a lot of repeats, but for a long, long time, you couldn't be the same restaurant twice. Although the same location with multiple restaurants was allowed. And there's like a cursed location in Andersonville, like just south of Clark, that's been at least five restaurants over the years.
I was gonna say, yeah. That's probably a lot where restaurants come and go.
Yeah,
their life expectancy is pretty short. You've got an in memoriam tonight to show the restaurants that are no longer with us.
Yeah.
But that's a big part. There are a lot of names that would bring back memories.
Yeah, there's a lot of restaurants. Lots. And actually, we're a detail-oriented club. We actually bought restaurantclub.com I think we paid $300 for that URL. And so we keep a list of all the restaurants and which ones have closed, and a lot, lots have closed over the years. So.
It's great to be here in this room tonight and to see all the people coming together with their families. What's it mean to you to celebrate this 20 years after it started?
Well, it's really like a celebration of friendship, right? Like these are people who have been my friends for 20, 30 years. And it's, you know, it's been a way we've stayed in touch. Like, even though people have, I moved away to Michigan and I still come back occasionally for Restaurant Club, and of course now for this anniversary, I think I'm still an official member of the club and is still assigned a week to pick once a year or so. Of course, we're thinking about what the future of Restaurant Club will be. We'll see.
That's
I don't think
it's that's for a different yeah, night. Yeah, that's yeah. not for tonight. Right?
Yeah, no. Today is about celebrating, 1,000.
Lisa Knight was also there at the beginning.
It initially started as a group of us had started getting together, making dinner. And like not everyone in our friend circle was someone who wanted to host a dinner. And so Priest was like, maybe we should have a group where we go out to eat instead of eating at home. And so it was just a fun way to hang out with your friends. After college, that gets a little harder. So.
And for you, as you're here 20 years later, 1,000 restaurants later, how does it feel to look around and to be celebrating?
It's crazy on a number of levels. Like, I think it, if we didn't have it, I question whether I would still have all these people in my lives. You know, not that I don't love them, but you fall out of touch. And it was a way that you just, like, stayed connected with people. And then just, like, seeing we were children basically when it started, and now seeing everyone with their families and seeing their kids grow up is crazy.
You would think that a group called Restaurant Club that visited 1,000 restaurants in 20 years would be all about the food, but as Matt Priest reflects, it's more than that.
I'm really happy. It is really great seeing everybody here, and I think for me it really just kind of it drives home the point that over the years, even for me specifically, it's gotten to be about people a little bit more than about restaurants. And so, like, tonight, we're not even at a restaurant. I knew we'd have a big group, so that's part of the reason logistically. But also, it's just like, let's just get everybody together in a real casual atmosphere and hang out and catch up. And so it's funny. Yeah, it's not so much about the restaurants anymore. And I guess that's what is I'm surprised to learn that about the club. But it's true. I'm looking around and it's really just about the people at this point. And it doesn't matter so much where we are, what we're eating. You know what I mean?
And as the club thinks about the next 20 years and the next 1,000 restaurants, the next generation needs to be ready to step up. Do you want to talk?
My dad is 43.
What is that?
It's a microphone.
It's fake.
It's a microphone.
You can listen to what you're saying.
Do you guys know what Restaurant Club is?
Yeah.
Do you guys, is this your first time at Restaurant Club?
No!
I know! when you grow up, do you want to be in Restaurant Club?
No!
Good stuff. That's good. Thank you. That was taped at Fairly Chicago, which is an event space over on the near west side on Bell, 339 North Bell. You can find out all you need to find out at restaurantclub.com, including all of the restaurants that they have attended, including the 1,000th, which was actually at the Fairly, but it was honey buttered fried chicken that was the food. More to come. Nolan Arenado with an error at third base. This is the guy they picked over K-Bry? Over Chicago and Chris Bryant? This guy in the All-Star game? Who's this guy? It's always the fun every time any guy comes up. This guy? This guy beat Jose Abreu? I don't like it. Gary Sanchez. This guy? Starting over James McCann? Flying out to center? Yeah. All right. You know, I thank the people at Restaurant Club for letting me crash their party. Literally. I think I crashed into the door, and those kids were adorable. It was fun. There were a lot of kids running around. And it's also, as we talk tonight about the pursuing the good life, there is something about that experience, as Matt Priest said in that piece, just this concept of, you know, it's not about restaurants, it's about people. But at the end of the day, I wish I would have done the story on your restaurant club, Pete.
Gastronauts?
Just because it feels like it'd be a much more meteoric rise, meteoric fall. You know, once the, you know, you're at restaurant 15 and everyone starts arguing about Portage Park or Edgewater and all the infighting, it just would have been a better kind of fire festival documentary type
thing.
Yeah,
this is not a feel good.
This was a feel good. Yeah. These guys got it done, but everybody wants to hear the chaos, the mess.
Yeah. We'd have, you know, like Tina Svondelis from the Sun-Times. Yeah. She was part of it like two times. And then we'd always say, like, hey, you come in the next one, you know, nothing.
Not even, just ghosting.
Like, you didn't have a good time eating with me?
And then you have dietary, not restrictions, but you don't eat meat.
Right.
And so everyone wants to go to a steak place. Right. You're like, no, I don't want to go.
Right.
Okay, I'll have the scallop potatoes. Can you eat scallop potatoes?
No. No. Fish. Or is it scallop potatoes? That's not fish, right?
It's close. It's close to fish.
Scallop potatoes, fish.
It's close.
They're like cheesy potatoes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, cheesy. Well, he doesn't eat cheese either, right?
No dairy.
Oh. So are you straight vegan?
I am vegan.
Wow. Well, there's a lot of places that are vegan that I would love to try.
Yeah,
so
but if I were,
this.
Jen, if I were in, we're already starting off, Jen DeSalvo, myself, Pete, we're going to start a new restaurant club for Extension 720, and we're going to pick restaurants, and we'll get listeners who text in. Because I would like to be in a spot like the restaurant club, where they're at their 1,000th restaurant, and starts right now. But I'm telling you, I'm not going to Edgewater.
Well, I like Jen's idea of going to every restaurant. Like, initially when I started the Gastronauts, mm-hmm. it was kind of based on, like, Anthony Bourdain and, like, going to, like, weird places. That was what I was thinking when I wanted to start it. And then, you know.
Just became like whatever's an eater. Right.
Right. Yeah. Right. And then it's like, you know, getting people together and coordinating schedules amongst 10 people.
I interviewed these guys. I probably put 20, 25 minutes. There's a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor, as they say. But one of the things they did talk about was that Matt had it in his quote, but this idea that at the beginning, they were really into the idea of almost. They would go to restaurants they knew they wouldn't like for the experience of how bad it was, or mm-hmm. you know, try something that was completely out of the realm for the fun of it. But as it got bigger and more people had just this much time to go have a restaurant experience, they're like, I don't want to go to Pasadita 42 on Broadway.
I got a
babysitter. Yeah. I want to go downtown. Yeah. I want to hit LaSalle Street. So how do we get over that so we don't have that happen? Because I'm going to have a harder time, you know, going to the crappier restaurant for fun. Like, that's something I'm not going to be into. I'm going to
be...
Yeah, I'm not looking for that.
We don't have time for that. We pick one restaurant in every neighborhood.
Yeah.
77 people.
So 77 restaurants.
Restaurants, excuse me, yeah.
That's not a bad idea. That's a good start.
77 restaurants, not necessarily 77 people, man. Some of them might not be able to fit all the...
I like that idea, though.
It is.
77 restaurants.
I mean, here's the thing. My husband and I are dinks. We, you know, don't have children. And so we don't get a thrill of going downtown to LaSalle Street because if we want to, we can do it. But I totally understand the people who just don't get out because they have to take care of their kids constantly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, having that one night where they're like, we got a babysitter, we got to do it up.
So. Yeah. So we have to avoid that. So anyone who's coming in, it can't be like I'm having the experience of a lifetime right now. Because you could go to any of the 77 restaurants and there's going to be an echelon or there's going to be a hierarchy of restaurants. There's going to be every restaurant, every neighborhood's going to have one restaurant that's really good and well, you know, well respected and well reviewed. And then there's going to be the neighborhood gem, and then there's going to be the one that you're like, I always see that one. What's that all about? Right? There's those three kind of restaurants. So we kind of have to find out, you know, the three of us have to come together and decide what kind of restaurant.
What are the criteria? We'll set an agenda and put some criteria down. Like each restaurant has to have at least two vegan sides.
Okay. I will say each restaurant's got to have meat and cheese. And it has to be on LaSalle Street. So that's my criteria. You guys, what are yours?
I would say that it's been the same restaurant for like a handful of years, not like the same owners under different names, because that typically means that the health department got to them and they had to close and reopen.
It up.
So something that's maybe had a little bit of a, you know.
I only want to go to places that have bottle service with the fireworks on the top of the bottle. So when you order the vodka and it comes out for like $250, the waitress brings it out and it's a sparkler.
Does this really happen?
This is a thing I see on YouTube. I've never experienced it in real life. But I'm sure GN, like a Rokan, knows this very well. Like, I feel like this would be Rokan. Rokan's probably the kind of guy who's just, he automatically is like, I'm not drinking this unless you put a sparkler in it.
Yeah. He's definitely the fireworks out of vodka guy.
So that's I need that. That's on my list of what I would like to see out of our restaurant.
I would suggest awesome desserts.
Okay.
Like skillet cookies.
Skillet cookies?
Yeah, like big cookies in a pan, all nice and warm with a ton of ice cream on it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess how we did it was each person picked for a month. Like, I would pick a month, the next person would pick a month.
That's how they do it here.
Down the line. So, Jen, when it's your turn to pick, you can pick any, you know, you pick the neighborhood and the restaurant that has skillet cookies. That's that's on you.
Right, that's on you.
Awesome.
And me.
You know, how many people are in this?
Right now, it's just three.
Yeah.
You, me, and Jen.
And possibly our spouses.
And possibly. I cannot speak for my spouse. I don't feel like she's going to go for this. So
she likes to go out to eat.
She does. Not with you guys.
What?
My wife can be very introverted when she wants to be. She'll say, I don't want to do that. It seems like I'm going to have to. And then she'll go out and have the time to be the center of attention and the center of the party.
It takes a lot to gain up the courage to talk to new people. It's a big deal. Yeah. I'm not being facetious at all, man.
Yeah. So that would be, you guys would be new people, but you're not really new people. You know, I feel like we'd get past that pretty quick. But so we've got so far, criteria is 77 neighborhoods. We're going to do that.
Yep.
No meat and cheese for Pete, right? Vodka with sparklers for me. Skillet cookies for Jen. That's where we're at, right? So we need to find a restaurant that's got all of that stuff. Because I think we should do it. I don't think we should do it where each month one of us picks. Because then quickly we'll start to not like each other. Because you'll pick a restaurant. And be like, oh, this is a crappy restaurant. This must be an extension of Pete's personality. I didn't like it. I don't like Pete. Therefore, we can't work together. And it just goes, it stumbles down a cliff.
I think that would be okay, though, just because of the fact that I've lived in this city my whole life. And as an adult, I've been, you know, living on my own here for like 14 years or whatever. And I go to the same three places constantly.
Yeah.
There's so much world-class food here. And I'm like, oh, hey, I'm going to get this burrito from the burrito place again.
Right.
And I'm going to do Thai from the Thai place, and that's it.
Yeah, that's I think that's a lot of people. That's so, myself included.
Yep. Just trying anything new I'd be okay with.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think this is a great idea. I think we're on it, and I could tell from the texters and the callers that they would come along. I think it'd be fun, right? We did, Pete. You and I did the Chicago Accent Challenge, which we did that for two years, year and a half or something, and we got to a point where we actually put the winners of the Chicago Accent Challenge on stage, and they did a tournament, and none of those people knew each other. They came out. They had a great time together. Everybody in the back. I wish I had a microphone on the green room because everyone was having a great time getting over their nerves. But the point is that the WGN listeners came together. With their only thing they had was the fact that they listened.
Yep.
And they had a great time. Everybody had a great time. They came out of there and everyone was like, this was so fun. It was such a community thing to have a stage show and all these kind of, it was a lot of fun and we recorded it and the whole bit. You can find it online. But the point is, I think the WGN listeners would quickly jump to something like this. We would be the ones that let them down because it would take about a week for us to go, we're doing what now? I don't want it. That Thursday doesn't work. Friday, I can't do it. We got stuff to do.
Yeah.
You and Jen, you're always running everywhere you go. All your Instagrams, you're running everywhere. You're exercising. You got time to eat.
No, you guys got to get this right. I run so I can eat.
Oh, is that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess we're thinking about the Extension 720 Restaurant Club. We're thinking about it. And sparklers and vodka. That's all I'm asking for. Well, hopefully we'll get that done. All right, coming up, Professor Al Genie joins us, our resident philosopher, to talk about the pursuit of the good life. It's Extension 720. Stay with us. Thanks, Jen. Thanks for the alligator update. Our guest in studio, our resident philosopher, Al Genie, the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. You are our expert for alligator watch.
I am. I just walked into the studio and heard this. But as a child, when my parents after the war, and so parents were taking vacations for the very first time, believe it or not, and they went to Florida and they left me with my grandparents, and they came back and they brought me a 12-inch baby alligator, which I paid $4 for, $5 for, kept in a cage. We put him in the bathtub. I kind of played with him, took him out of the bathtub, and fed him anything that we had, so on and so forth. But hundreds of other parents were doing the same thing as well. And so suddenly you had this phenomenon. Everyone's heard the old notion of, there are alligators in the sewers of New York. Well, there were in the 50s and 60s because people flushed them down the toilets, et cetera, and they grew for other very, very hardy animals that could live for years and years and years on very little food. And so, and when I went to Garfield Park for day camp, there used to be little alligators
there you go.
In the water.
So this is not a new phenomenon
not
for
new
Chicago.
Phenomenon.
And you see, I think it was Rob Elbergus, somebody tweeted out that, you know, this is something that happens. There were some archival stories in Lake Waukegan, Lake Michigan. The alligator story continues to be...
It continues. Now, the reality is that if this guy is 5 or 6 feet long, that means this is not a young pup. This means they grow by inches.
Do you know how...
Years.
Jen, do you know how big the... the alligator is, Pete, do you know? Do we have any idea of how long this alligator is?
So we had Gator Rob on the Rokan show earlier. And even though initial reports were 4 to 5 feet, he thinks it's more like 2 to 3 feet with a long tail.
Still, he's talking about 7 to 10 years.
Oh, look at you.
Wow.
You're just coming up with this. What are you?
Well, the most scary thing in my whole life was 20 years ago, my wife and I were in Africa, and we're in a pond where the animals are drinking, and it's in the middle of winter there, so it's just mud. And they were down there, and suddenly out of that mud flew a 17-foot-long crocodile. I am not kidding. That took that antelope in one bite and went back into the mud.
Like a nature
and would
film.
Never move again for 6 months. And we sat there, and the guy said, "You don't usually see that."
So gross.
Moving along. Professor Al Genie is here. He joins us whenever. I want to say monthly, but it's with all the preemption from the White Sox. It becomes regularly.
Great
to see you.
Great to be seen.
And thank you for the insight on Gatorgate here in Chicago tonight. But we want to talk about, and this is kind of the theme of the show tonight, the pursuit of the good life.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something that you... brought to our attention, you said, okay, let's talk about three great philosophers and we'll talk about what this means.
Yeah.
Because when I hear that, when I hear pursuing the good life, I'm like, well, what does that mean? Does that mean my pursuit of all things that are going to make me feel good? Is it the pursuit of easy street? Like, what does the pursuit of the good life mean to you, Al?
Well, this whole conversation really started with, and why I offered this as a kind of three thinkers who have offered us different ways of looking at life from a philosophical point of view. And I think what's really important to understand right now, philosophy is not poetry. Philosophy is not just, let's play speculative harmonics with words. I think philosophy is really an attempt to understand something below the surface. So, does a good life include the good life, the material good life? Yes, indeed it does. But philosophy asks, at what price? And what are you willing to do to get it? And what do you have to give up to achieve it? And all these specific issues. So I think when we're talking about the good life here, this really stems out of our first conversation when I came back after we had our little break there for a while. When you had asked me, what's the favorite philosophy book you ever read? And I said, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And in that book, in that discussion we had last time, Frankl talks about this desperate need for meaning, that we seek meaning, that without meaning we give up life, we don't have purpose, we don't have direction, and that we are desperate seekers of purpose in life. But he doesn't offer any specific purpose, doesn't give any details about what that should be. He talks about how the assumption here is because he's talking about Auschwitz and the genocide, about survival, family, et cetera, et cetera.
You have to live the life if you're going to philosophize the life.
Right, you have to live the life. But he was really, he offered us this notion that the good life is about something more than just sustaining oneself and finding purpose, and that is knowing the difference between me, us, and you, and then making those distinctions and knowing how they all work. But he didn't fill that in. So what is a meaningful life? tapioca, perhaps a great deal of money.
Hey, I love a tapioca.
Listen, who's against tapioca?
Who's against
what
tapioca?
What a lovely thing a tapioca is. That's a Philip Roth whole routine about a Jewish mother making tapioca. But the reality is, I wanted to come up with some real ideas. One of the criticisms of philosophy is, well, again, it's poetry. You just talk voids. But more than words, I want to offer three thinkers tonight. Benjamin Franklin, literally one of the great founding fathers, great minds. You know, I think we venerate the founding fathers. We're finding out because of a play that changed our understanding of history that there weren't that many smart ones there. But there were a couple smart ones, including Alexander Hamilton, who may, in fact, be responsible for 60% of our understanding of the Constitution and understanding of modern politics. And Jefferson certainly played a part in that, but it was Hamilton who really formed the Constitution more than anything else. But Franklin was a founding father, literally a founding father, but from the time he was a young man, he was trying to build a civilization, trying to make Philadelphia real, trying to make Philadelphia a minor Paris. Never quite occurred.
That's a nice city.
But you have to remember, Philadelphia was our first capital. Right. Philadelphia was more important to New York than any other city in America until well into the 19th century.
Okay, so we got Benjamin Franklin.
Franklin was one of them. Then, you know, I wanted to cross the pond because we're so interested, because this week my favorite person is the English ambassador to America. just for his witty way of phrasing things, et cetera, et cetera. Bertrand Russell. We're sitting across from the University of Chicago. Bertrand Russell won the Nobel Prize. University of Chicago claims Bertrand Russell as one, because he was there that year as a guest lecturer. But Bertrand Russell is a curmudgeon philosopher, this man who understood mathematics. The reason your computer works, the reason computers exist at all, is partially because of Bertrand Russell and Principia Mathematica that he wrote with Whitehead, this understanding of mathematics at another level. But he was also this curmudgeon philosopher who wanted to talk about how do we balance life beyond mathematics, et cetera, et cetera. And then, I always mispronounce it, I pronounce it Mahatma Gandhi, this little man, by the way, who really got his bones in South Africa. People don't realize. He formed his political points of view. He formed the African National Congress, helped form the African National Congress, and then went to India both as a philosopher, prophet, and a politician, and helped free that. By the way, my favorite Gandhi quote, so I don't forget it, and when coming back to England after World War II and was all over, now he's come back as Gandhi. Now Gandhi the sage in his loincloth.
He's capital G Gandhi, you know, at this
capital
point.
Capital G
right,
Gandhi
right,
at this
right.
point. And they ask him, the British correspondents were sent to him, well, how does it feel to be in civilization? What do you think about civilization, Mr. Gandhi? And he looks at him and he says, that is a very good idea.
Brilliant kind of man.
So I think these three men offer us real handles.
Let's do this, because you've got great notes here, and we'll talk about Benjamin Franklin. We'll talk as well about Bertrand Russell and Mahatma Gandhi coming up here as we talk about their philosophy when it comes to the pursuit of the good life. We'll do that coming up right after the break. Professor Al Genie, our resident philosopher, is here. So let's get to it. Extension 720. Professor Al Genie in studio, our resident philosopher. He is the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business. He's also the author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. He's a regular contributor here to Extension 720. Tonight we talk about the pursuit of the good life. Three philosophers, three giants, really, talking about what this means, and we're going to get through all three of them. Let's start with Benjamin Franklin. People, I think that's probably going to be the one that most listeners are going to know about because obviously he
but
has...
But they know about him because of the keychain in the sky and electricity and the Franklin stove, which changed domesticity in America because you really had heat, et cetera, et cetera. And they know him, again, for being the founding father and the first great international diplomat, that he went to France and convinced a lot of people to, you know, back the revolution, to offer us money, et cetera, et cetera.
I didn't realize this because I read The British Are Coming, the book. We just did a long conversation about it.
Yeah.
and I should have known this, but Benjamin Franklin had already lived a life.
Yeah.
By the time the Revolution came around. He was only around, I think he died not too long after the war,
After the Constitution. After the Constitution.
He was already a statesman.
And don't forget, in the 60s in those days.
It was like the 80s.
Washington died at 63.
Right.
And he was an old man. And he died of a very strange infection in his throat, but without going into that. So don't forget, lifespan was an entirely different thing.
Right,
he was an old man established. But even as a young man, he was an entrepreneur. He was always a creator. He was always this. He was a product of the Enlightenment without being necessarily in touch with the Enlightenment in Europe. He wasn't Jefferson. Jefferson read everything. In fact, one of the great phenomena that people don't realize, he spoke four or five languages, including Italian. And by the way, who do you think introduced spaghetti to America? Thomas Jefferson, to feed his slaves as a product. Okay, so Jefferson was really a polymath and a polyglot and could do all these things, but Franklin was a real guy. But a curious real guy and a printer and a publisher. And at the age of 20, he realized that societies don't really work by just having stuff, but by the values that the societies are based on. And those values are always individual. So what we have to do is come up with not simply the Ten Commandments, and by these Ten Commandments, take the first four away if you know, and the other six are really rules by which civilization people can live in civilization, right? This is where Freud is right. You gave up, you recognize that property equals real property and your wife and your husband and how you manage all these things. But Franklin said, we need guidelines by which that we can found societies, communities, and nations. And so he came up with some really basic, 13 of them.
So these are his virtues. These are things he used to guide his life.
And remember what a virtue is. I'm not going to quiz you on this now because your last quiz was, ladies and gentlemen, just abominable.
The virtue is it's a cider, right?
Virtue is a cider. Yeah, that's right. Jason's virtue cider. It's delicious. Virtue is a habit that you choose to perform which increases the pleasure or the goodness of life.
Okay.
So running every day, it's a habit you choose that increases the good life.
So virtues are what you're pursuing. When you talk about the pursuit of the good life.
You choose to practice, to watch your diet.
That's great, okay.
So virtue is not this mysterious sacred thing. It is an action you choose to do.
Okay.
So he comes up with 13 virtues. Starts off with temperance. Do not eat to dullness. Do not drink to elevation. Because one of the major problems, Lincoln still talked about it. What did everybody do? Grant drank. Everybody drank. Why did they drink? The water wasn't clean. What else did you have? You got up in the morning and you worked until it was dark, and then what did you do? But Franklin was very aware of that. You had to control that, otherwise you had mobs.
That's a great point. Eat not to dullness.
Yeah.
And drink not to elevation.
Right. In fact, just recently on another station known as NPR, they talked about this report about people who sit all day long, then go home and watch television all night, have a higher incidence of heart attack.
No doubt.
I mean, the old argument is you're not doing anything, you're eating a great deal, you want a pleasure, and so that you get. So the reality is, we got to watch that.
Right.
Aren't we a phobic right now about fat in this society? That's a great book title, by the way, Phobic About Fat, but we'll come to that. The second one is silence. Speak, but do not feel obligated to speak continuously.
Spoken like a true talk show guest. That's
a few. No, seriously.
I know.
Silence. I mean, I think there's something, silence is golden. Well, knowing when not to say something is as important as knowing when to say something. And I think that's what he's talking about, that empty-handed conversation. I remember going to Italy as a student in the early 60s, or was it the early 40s or 50s? I can't remember, it's so long ago. In the early 60s, and going to these little villages, and these men are sitting around, they're both playing little domino games, and talking. And what they were talking about was nothing, but the need to talk is part of it. But the excess talk breeds less than acuity and less than logical performance.
Okay, so
order.
Science. Order.
Yeah, you know where things fit. Understand there's an order. Understand this procedure. My wife is a logistics specialist. She understands the sequence of things. She understands how you do things. She understands when you do things. And she tells me exactly what to do. And you know what? It works.
It works.
There is something about organization
order. And order. Okay.
Right? Resolution. when you do set out to do something, finish it. Don't start anything with a half result.
So if
isn't that what you complain your kid about all the time?
And also, we just started. We kind of started a restaurant club, Pete, Jen, and I. So now that's a great point. Resolution. We need to finish it. We just started it.
Yeah.
We can't just let it die in the vine.
Right. Right. I mean, but
if we want to pursue a good life,
if you want to pursue a good life, no, just to preside an organized life as well. Anything else? I mean, everybody wish that you had done half the things you talked about.
Yeah.
But I think there are things that can't be done and you dream about. But when you decide to do something, do it whole hog.
Isn't that at the core why we come up with bucket lists? Isn't that the idea that we're like,
but
when
we're
it
also
comes
talking
to resolution?
About practical things like I'm going to quit drinking. That doesn't mean I'm only going to have two drinks a day. It means I'm going to quit drinking. And that resolution, and you know, the AA, I've had some difficulties with AA. I'm not a member of AA, and I don't think I'm an alcoholic. But the reality is, the real message is not necessarily the God part, although that's an important part. It's being sober is day to day, one day at a time. And because every day is hard enough to do it. And you can't resolve to do something your whole life, but you can resolve to get through the day. And because you are, you know, one drink is too many and two drinks are never enough, right?
Right.
And so there's this real problem. So resolve.
Okay, so resolve.
And I talked about that with students all the time. Frugality. Make no expense that you don't necessarily need, but really about waste nothing. And this is now a primitive society. But frugality here is we live in a consumer society. We buy stuff rather than fix stuff. We reduplicate things for no reason whatsoever. I wonder how much we could really save by just cutting back. Yeah. One of the new things in the economy right now, they're talking about, gee, we've got this great employment rate. But people aren't buying a lot. Now, remember, this whole system is based on consumption. But for reality, for private well-being, you need to be somewhat frugal.
Right.
Industry, actually work.
So work fits in here?
And work really fits in here. The work is necessary, work is good, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
Should we go through this? Sure.
Yeah, let's keep going.
Yeah. Sincerity, that is, don't lie. Don't say anything. I mean, this seems obvious, isn't it? That if you're going to say something, say it clearly. Say it exactly. Don't overly embellish. Tell me what you really think. Don't just superfluous words, the cosmetic covering of candy, you know, confectionery kind of words. You need something more than that. And to depend on something is the greatest thing you could say about a friend. I can depend on them. Okay? Justice. We don't expect to be injured. We have to make the commitment not to injure others. We have to be concerned about
justice is a good one.
Yeah.
Moderation.
Moderation.
Yep.
I mean, what thinker doesn't talk about that? And moderation, and Aristotle always talked about do everything in moderation. He did not mean the following, which undergraduates always think. If there are 500 women in Athens, it would be excessive to sleep with all of them, and it would be ridiculous to sleep with none of them, so the golden mean is 250 of them. That's not
That's
what we
not
mean
that.
By moderation. Moderation is understanding that, you know, it's that last, remember in the Monty Python, the meaning of life, just one more bite, remember? And then he explodes.
That's great.
Okay.
All right, we got to go quick through these here.
Cleanliness.
I mean,
but believe it or not, it's huge.
It's interesting to see that Benjamin Franklin has that in there. Of course.
Cleaning oneself. Tranquility. That is, understand what you're going to get mad about and understand what you're not going to get mad. Understand what to let go of. As a parent, we both know there are times you either get in there full face or
battles.
Just shut
up. Right, absolutely.
Chastity.
Chastity.
He doesn't mean it. He means that venery, sexuality, is a good thing, but one shouldn't get lost in it as the only pursuit. Mm. And finally, humility. And this is his phrase, imitate Jesus and Socrates. That's the brand of most Unitarians, and that is these individuals.
It's fascinating, too, and we got to take a break, but Benjamin Franklin, known for so many different things, to be a philosopher and to really plan out or to give a roadmap for these virtues. It's not something I would think was part of his repertoire, but it was.
But it was. And in fact, I'll tell you one other thing. He was the founder of the American Philosophical Society.
There you go.
Which still is in existence and which I'm still a member.
All right. Professor Al Genie in studio, our resident philosopher here on Extension 720. We're talking about the pursuit of good life. Benjamin Franklin, we're going to talk about Bertrand Russell and Mahatma Gandhi coming up here on Extension 720. We'll take a break, get the news. Stay with us. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN, high atop the Chicago River. The mouth of the Chicago River. Beautiful night tonight here in Chicago. Some oppressive temperatures coming through tomorrow. Maybe some severe weather tonight. But wow, what a night here to do radio broadcast across the plains. 720 WGN, and talk about the pursuit of the good life. Professor Al Genie is here. He is a professor of business ethics at Loyola University Chicago, the Quinlan School of Business. And he also is our resident philosopher, as well as the author of the book, The Importance of Being Funny. Sorry about that, Al.
It's all right.
Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. I know the book. I just couldn't remember all the words you strung together.
I can't either, and I wrote them, so that makes it more difficult.
All right, so we got through Benjamin Franklin in the first part, so let's continue our conversation. Right. Three philosophers that really have set up what we're talking about, the pursuit of the good life.
Can I just make one correction? Yeah. Let's not call them philosophers, because that's a bad name. It's like calling somebody a gerbil.
Aren't you a philosopher?
Yeah, I am, but I think for a lot of people, that's a negative. These are great thinkers.
Okay.
And Bertrand Russell certainly was a PhD in mathematics and in philosophy. And Bertrand Russell was, I think, a very curious and wonderful fellow. He was a social liberal. He was also a follower of both the English and the French Enlightenment. That is, he had read Locke and Rousseau and Montesquieu and Diderot, but he really believed in the power of reason, and that reason is the key here, that our only and great talent was reason. That's why his fascination with mathematics and so on and so forth.
I would only put him in a mathematical category.
Yeah.
I guess you're right to say philosophers are not. I just did not know much about him outside of math.
Well into his 80s and 90s, he was part of, it was the anti-Vietnam protests, and he lived a long life with many, many wives and many, many mistresses, and a pursuit of the good life was for him a life of reason. And he gives these 10 rules, and these 10 rules are also based on how socially.
So these are the rules about pursuing a good life.
His 10 rules. Number one, do not feel absolutely certain about anything. Recognize that reason has to be come to, or deal with reason, that a certainty, there's this wonderful, wonderful story of one Brahmin talking to another Brahmin in the Indian tradition and saying, and what holds the universe together? And the other Brahmin says, the universe is held together because it is on an elephant's back. And the Brahmin says, yes, and what holds up the elephant? And the other Brahmin looks at him and says, a turtle, of course. And so what Russell was talking about, you know, to be absolutely certain about anything, that you have to think it through, not simply believe something to be true.
I believe this to be relevant today. I find myself more often than not, especially in the world we live in, where information just comes at us, and it uses the same channels.
Yeah.
You know, it uses the same channel, so you're like, that must be true. That must be true. And I'm finding myself more and more, not just in my profession, but as in my personal life, to recognize that there is uncertainty in the certainty.
Yeah, you know, this media, this wonderful thing that gives us access to so much, is still susceptible to Goebbels' threat and prognostication that say the big lie often and frequently enough and hard enough and becomes a big truth.
Right.
So there is a danger to this. Right now on HBO, they're doing that special on Roger Ailes, and it's clearly the case that he was going to mismanage the truth by simply repeating it again and again and again. So there's, be absolutely certain of nothing. Now, the danger in that is, what is a surety? How can you proceed? But what he's really saying is, don't believe in something just because it's a belief. You know, I'm a Catholic because my parents are a Catholic.
Right.
No, choose to be a Catholic.
Choose to be.
Or choose to be.
To quote a modern day philosopher, Flavor Flav, don't believe the hype.
That's right.
That's what he said. So. Helping you out.
I read them all the time. I just forgot that quote. Secondly, do not think it worthwhile to proceed by concealing evidence. Evidence is the key to reason.
Don't cover it up.
Don't cover it up. Deal with it. I mean, you never want to talk about this. You know, denial does work. I want to suggest that denial, is not just a river in Egypt, you know. But denial does work. You know, I've got cancer and this is a terrible fate, and I could deny it perhaps denial helps. But when you're really talking about the larger things in life, you know, deal with what's in front of you. Don't just deal with pipe dreams. What leads you to is madness.
That's great.
Never try to discourage the thinking Never try to discourage thinking, for you are sure to succeed. When you discourage thinking, when you say, there's where denial comes in. When you deny thinking, you absolutely prove the point. You're not thinking about it at all. Number four, when you meet with opposition, even if you should, even if it comes from your husband or your children, endeavor to overcome it by argument and not by authority.
Mm.
I remember my father saying to me, and father said to you, as long as you live in my house,
right,
you'll live by my rules.
Right.
Yeah, that's authority. But there was another argument here I wanted, and I said to him once, but why do I want to live in your house?
I have to say, this is one that I think a lot of young parents probably can hone in on and understand, because I have an 11-year-old son. He's about to turn 12. He's questioning everything.
Everything.
And I delight in the argument. My wife delights in the authority.
Yeah.
She in this way that she will be like, why are you even arguing
it's
about
easy.
This?
It's easier to say. It's because
it is.
Because it is.
And I'm like, well, why do you think that? And I'm causing, and there's no doubt I'm causing strife. But at the same time, I'm trying to get at the lessons that are learned through trying to think something out.
Right. And I think
super annoying.
And when he's talking about this whole history, it is super annoying. He's talking about this whole history that fiat voluntatis tuus, my will be done, is a way of managing life. But it's not a way of understanding life and understanding what you're doing. Oh,
absolutely,
in life.
Man.
Okay.
That's great.
Have no respect for authority of others. But always look for the contrary. Authorities can always be found. The theme here is clear. Think your way through this. Don't just act because you've been told. Don't just knee-jerk. You're responsible for yourself. Integrity means this unity of beliefs, and that I'm responsible for my beliefs. That means you should be responsible for your thoughts and your actions. Yeah.
I'm digging Bertrand Russell.
Yeah, there's a lot there to be said.
Yeah.
Do not use power to suppress opinions. It's a way to because that will suppress you as well as others.
That
power, does all power is absolute and all power is power. Excuse me, try that again. Lord Acton, absolute power corrupts, and it does. And so you have to be very careful how you use power.
Al. Next,
right? You know, as a parent, how many times can you say X?
Right.
And then you're.
I know, as a talk show host, right, what are you talking about? Right. That's like the idea of what I say goes, right?
Sometimes. Number seven, do not fear to be eccentric in your opinion. Eccentricity is the catalyst for change. And I think every idea isn't great. We were talking about artists. You just quoted that chap. But you know
Flavor
what?
Flav. Yeah, I'm not sure we're really talking about contemporary artists, but go ahead.
But you know what I mean here.
Yeah.
I think eccentricity is the growing point in life. And eccentricity, that's what art is about. You put something out there and it creates a thought, something greater than itself.
It also combats the group thought. This idea that my opinion doesn't matter because it's not the mainstream opinion that's happening.
Eccentricity does not necessarily mean being the oddball, being the dark villain. Doesn't mean being obnoxious, but it means I think my own thoughts. I'm responsible for my own self.
And it seems to be a trend here. When you look at all of these, it's this idea of thinking it through.
Right.
And if you do these things and you think through, you will get to a point where your opinion may be different.
And again, this is the thoughts you keep.
I love it.
This is the thoughts of a mathematician, because a mathematician will say,
my favorite mathematician,
S equals
ever.
M equals P, therefore S equals P. Because if the first term is equal to the second term and the second term is equal to the third term, the first term is equal to the third term. And he's trying to do that. Think.
Love it.
Find pleasure in intellectual dissent rather than passive agreement. Passive agreement will get you friends, but will not get you truth. You know?
Come on.
Think about it. Think about that.
I feel like I need to do a little bit more research on this dude. I like this guy a lot.
And remember, tomorrow is the midterm, so you're in trouble. Number nine, be scrupulously truthful. Truth is not something that's convenient or inconvenient. It simply is.
Okay.
And I think, again, this denial thing, to say I've got cancer and now I'm going to deny what all the options are is not the same thing as I'm not going to deal with my cancer at all.
Right.
You know, I mean, there can be something good in denial. My wife is a paraplegic. She's not, and I'm just going to deny that and try to live around that. That's therapeutic. But you can't deny that she's a paraplegic. You can't deny that your child needs help. Interesting, last night I watched Joe Biden talk about his son, second son, who has some real emotional and mental health problems. And he said, we don't deny it here. We work with it. And he has a chance to be better. And number 10, do not feel envious of the happiness of those who live in a fool's paradise, for only a fool will think that they are truly happy.
That's great.
You know, a bottle of bourbon may not get you to solve all your problems, but for tonight it will.
Bertrand Russell, It's hard to top, but maybe we can do that. Mahatma Gandhi coming up next.
All right.
But this was great as we pursue the good life. We
good
talk
life.
About Benjamin Franklin and now Bertrand Russell. We'll continue here on Extension 720 with our resident philosopher Al Genie right after the break. So stay with us. Man, I'm looking for the good life. Something that you can't imagine. Something you don't know. Man, I'm looking for the good life. Baby girl, I gotta in pursuit of the good life. Professor Al Genie is here. He's our resident philosopher on Extension 720. And he is giving us three different perspectives on that pursuit of the good life. We heard about Benjamin Franklin. We just had a great session on Bertrand Russell. My favorite mathematician of all time. And now we wrap up our conversation, our last thinker, Mahatma Gandhi.
Yeah, and I want to put Gandhi into perspective. We don't have much time, but I want to give the essence of what he's talking about. Gandhi was both a spiritual individual who believed in a way of looking at life and the dignity of life, and also a politician who was a masterman at it and also a master planner and also had his faults, et cetera, et cetera. But he offered a list of seven deadly sins in the real world.
And so we did the seven deadly sins,
they're what? And remember, they were about these little personal faults, et cetera, pride and envy and sloth and anger. But here's Gandhi talking about the real sins are the sins you commit against others. Mm. And so sin is always public.
And that gets in the way of the pursuit of the good life, because the good life, as we're talking about, is not necessarily about your life.
That's right.
It's about living the good
know
life.
Know the difference between me, us, and we.
Right. So, I'm learning. See, I can learn.
You're still having a hard time passing this course. We'll talk about your mother's called. We'll talk later. Anyway, Gandhi's list of seven deadly sins is social. First of all, wealth without work is abominable. Just simply to have money and to live a life just on the backs of others becomes this, you know, this abominable notion. He was talking about the colonial period there, where the English lived off the work of the Indians, and so on and so forth. But he meant that across the board.
And we're seeing it. I mean, that is a contemporary issue, of course.
It's a real issue. Yeah. Pleasure without conscience. Yes, pleasure is something to be pursued, but at what price?
Right. What's the consequence?
We've got this guy in the news right now. Pleasure, sexuality is a good thing, not with children.
Right.
And there are consequences to that. Science without humanity. You know, our big concern right now are we going to have genetic babies. I've had my friend Ron Green on years and years ago. We did that as a show about planning your babies. Well, there are a good side to that. So we could get rid of that gene in you that leads to epilepsy. We get rid of that gene in you that leads to perhaps lung cancer. Hmm. But we also, there's a danger of, can we make an army of Schwarzeneggers?
And I think this also goes to number one, number two, but just this idea that it becomes about money.
Right.
Or it becomes about something else besides humanity.
Right, it's kind of humanity. And science has to be really about the service of humankind, not simply the advancement of egos. Knowledge without character.
Oh, I'm out.
I mean, right, boom, me too. I've learned, I had a big insight on my trip, and I really want to share this with you, that I'm well-read, but I'm not wise. Mm. And I think that there's a real difference, and that's what he's talking about. Just to be smart, but to have no integrity, to have no values, makes you a very dangerous person. Mm.
I think you're talking about Wall Street.
I'm thinking I'm talking about what was the character in the Batman series, the Joker?
The Joker.
The smartest guy there, but always the most dangerous. Mm. Politics without principles. Ah, that never will happen, will it? Imagine that. Politics without principles. The whole purpose of politics is the well-being of the polis. That's what it means in Greek. The well-being of the polis. The well-being of the community itself. So without knowing those things, you're just a manager rather than being in charge. Mm-hmm. Commerce without morality. Okay, so I teach business ethics. This one appeals to me. But think about that. What is the purpose of commerce? We keep forgetting that. Purpose of commerce is to make life better. To make life, you know...
I think the purpose is making as much money as possible for myself.
Oh, that's... Again, you're failing this course.
I know, I understand, but I think that commerce, that word, it's very interesting. Yeah. That word has shifted over time. Commerce is about money.
Making money. But the purpose of commerce is to make life better. And I'll give you a classic example. The back of your pair of Levi's. It's two mules trying to pull a pair of pants apart. Because when Levi's first met Levi's in San Francisco, they were 22 cents a piece. Cowboys came in every year and bought two pair, one to work in all day and one to dress up on Saturday. 22 cents a piece, and you couldn't rip them apart. Mm. It was a service, okay? And finally, worship without sacrifice. That is, to say I really love my children, but not to send them to school. To say I really love my children, but not to vaccinate them, not to have a crisis on our hands right now or a debate on our hands. To say I love my wife, but to have a mistress. To say I'm concerned about my community, but never to tithe. That is... To believe something without acting on it makes you a hollow man, makes you a hollow person.
As we wrap this up, and you know, you brought us these three, and you think about, you know, the concept of pursuing the good life, why is it important? Why at the end, when you read all this stuff, and it's all great, it's all the rules for us to follow,
right.
But at the end of the day, why is it important?
Because we don't live alone. Because we live with others, and others requires us to ask a question beyond self. And the good life means to live well with others. Socrates is right. Philosophy is not about the pursuit of wisdom, monies, or power. It's the pursuit of learning to live well with others. Mm-hmm. And so that's what it's about for me.
Great to see you, as always.
Good to be seen.
And I appreciate you bringing this in and doing the work to enlighten us all. Professor Al Genie, the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. He's also the resident philosopher here on Extension 720 and the author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. We'll see you soon.
I hope so.
This is my last night. What? That's what you said last time. This is my goodbye. Gotta quit this life.
No more 5 a.m.
That's what you said last time. I'm tired of watching the sun come up. You gotta quit this life. I need to find somewhere they don't know my name. I see the party move on, but the people don't change in this magic city.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a familiar voice to music fans. Mr. Hudson is a singer-songwriter from Birmingham, England. He's well known here in the States for lending his talents to songs by Janelle Monáe, John Legend, Kanye West, and Jay-Z. He was featured on the track Young Forever. But now he's back with his own album, which is called When the Machine Stops. It's his first in 10 years. The album features prominent Chicago hip-hop artists like Vic Mensa and Taylor Bennett. Mr. Hudson is here in Chicago, working with some great Chicago musicians this week, and he's my guest on Extension 720. Mr. Hudson, great to have you here.
Hello, hello.
For you to put out music 10 years after the fact, is that something that you think about, the fact that it's been a decade since you've put your own music out?
It's funny, time just flies if you're not careful, if you don't put a leash around its neck, it will just absolutely run away from you like a wild horse. For me, it's not 10 years. It's like 5 minutes. I've been working on a lot of other people's projects in that time. I sort of evolved into the producer, writer, right, headspace. It all sort of happened when I was crowd surfing at a festival in the UK and I broke my foot, which meant the doctor said you can't fly for six, ideally 3 months, I think it was, because of the internal bleeding would have killed me if I got on a plane. Anyway, too much information. So I said, okay, well, if I've got to cancel all my shows and I'm not allowed to get on a plane, what do I do? You know, I couldn't even drive my beloved Jaguar around London. What trouble am I going to get into with a broken foot? So I thought, okay, I'm going to build a studio. I'm going to figure out what all the buttons do and the faders and the dials and twiddle all the knobs, and I'm going to become a grown-up producer. And I did that. And it took me about 4 or 5 years to figure it out. So I was locked away in my studio in London. The foot had healed by the end of that time. And by the end of that period, I was producing a Duran Duran record. And when I did that, I was like, okay, maybe I figured it out.
I figured it out. When you're at that level. But there's something to be said. I mean, you as a young musician coming up, did you have aspirations to produce the music? Did you think, hey, this is...
Heavens no. Does anyone really want to be in a windowless room, staring at a computer screen, twiddling knobs and faders? And it's a maddening process because it's like a Rubik's Cube. But it's like, you know, it's more complicated than a Rubik's Cube, because a Rubik's Cube is three-dimensional, but when you're listening to a song, playing it back over and over, you've got time as well to deal with, so that's four dimensions.
Well, music is such a collaborative art form, and you have been collaborative with your band and in the past.
Yeah.
But you even talk about in some interviews with the new record that you went with almost an... you almost isolated yourself.
Yeah, I did exactly the opposite. I've always been known as a collaborator, and I'm a sociable guy, and I'm very sociable in my music making, but it's almost like I've come full circle. You know, when I was 13, 14, trying to figure out how to write songs in my bedroom back home, you know, with my brother's guitar on my, you know, on my lap, sitting on the end of the bed, trying to figure out, you know, G to B minor, to trying to figure out other people's songs and then write my own. You know, I've come almost come full circle with this album, where I said to myself, okay, I'm going to lock myself away in an Airbnb or in my in a friend's, you know, pool house or whatever in LA, and you know, avoid all distractions and just, I think you call it woodshedding here. I'm going to woodshed this. Just me, the laptop, microphone, and some headphones. Make an album, see what it sounds like. Because for me, that was kind of like breaking new ground, because I'd been collaborating for so long. That was more of a challenge than everyone else is trying to get in the room with somebody or trying to slide in the DMs and make things happen. And I thought, no, I need to do the opposite. I need to stop being in rooms with other people. I need to just figure it. It's a sort of man in the mirror
moment.
Was
that challenging for you? I mean, yeah. I would say as a people person, as a very charming guy who obviously you've made your career by having great relationships with other musicians. Was
it's
it
all
hard
about
to just,
people.
Was it hard to isolate yourself?
It was, because, you know, anyone can play guitar, right? The music business, which is how you get records out and how things happen, is actually about people, not about music. The music's the fun bit, but figuring out how to navigate the music business, that's the actual job in hand. So yeah, it was a real change for me. And it kind of makes it feel like a debut album, because I produced and mixed this thing on my laptop, and then I sort of came out into the daylight, and I was like, what year is it? Who's the president? let's not go down that road. But I sort of came, you know, bleary-eyed. It felt like years later, but it was actually 6 months. And I said, look, I've got a record. Who wants to listen to it? So here we are.
When you're going through that, when you're isolating yourself and you're putting out new work, where do you pull from inspiration? Because you've done so many great things in the last decade. I mean, I just mentioned a couple of the artists that you've worked with. To really dig into some of the songs and some of the groundbreaking, forward-thinking artists that you've worked with, where does the inspiration for your own work come from? When you get away from all the others who are doing their thing and you're collaborating with them, what's your sound?
That's a really good question. And funnily enough, it's not music. And I think it's not silly for people to sit down and listen to music to inspire their music. But look outside of that. You know, look up from, as we say in soccer, look up from the ball, you know. And look up and around you and think, hang on, maybe I can be inspired by this coffee table book on Chicago's architecture. Maybe I can be inspired by watching movies or reading books, or maybe I can be inspired by people, by a conversation. Maybe I can just go and sit on the bus, sit on the train and eavesdrop and, you know, read people's texts over their shoulders. I don't know. You might find something more original. And then when you feed all of that stuff from third-party places into your music, it's necessarily going to be different to anything you're hearing on the radio or on your playlist.
When you get the opportunity to do your own work and you think about, and that's what I love about the record. The record is very precise, but it's very patient. And it's not, I got to get to the hook and I got to get to, you know, what people know of me. There's a, even with the song Chicago with Vic Mensa, and even the first track on the album.
Antidote, yeah.
Antidote. This idea that it seems that you're experimenting or exploring space inside of the note.
And space is a really good word. I think I'm all kind of an old-fashioned Englishman who likes an album to be a place, to create rooms and then something for you as the listener to walk into, to have some space for you to walk into and not to fill in all the gaps. Right. So I gave myself a limited palette. I'm a fan of cool school jazz, so Miles Davis and Chet Baker and so on. And I love how limited the palette is. I think Miles, I'm going to be, you know, misquoting him, but he said something along the lines of, you don't need more than five people on stage. And it's interesting when you're producing, despite the fact that you have the technological ability to have hundreds of tracks, what if you only had five plus a vocal? So let's call it six. You know, what if you didn't have backing vocals until you got to the chorus? Things like that. You can set yourself little rules and play little games, and being minimal is one of those. But to go back to your previous question about inspiration, I think for me specifically, it was very much a sci-fi headspace. I was watching a lot of Black Mirror. I was watching a lot of old sci-fi movies, Kubrick particularly, and reading, you know, short stories. I didn't necessarily give myself time for a 300-page novel, but something like The Machine Stops by Ian Forster is like 50 pages long. So that's what I do, you know, when I'm right. when I'm not making music, and but I want to get inspired.
Producer, singer, songwriter, Mr. Hudson in studio. His new album is called When the Machine Stops. It's out now. It features some great Chicago artists like Vic Mensa and Taylor Bennett. We'll continue our conversation here on Extension 720 with Mr. Hudson. So stay with us.
You'll be back. You'll see sooner or later. You'll run. You wanted time, but we've only got so much, and it's weighed in gold. I weigh my time in gold. So that's how you're going on. You pack your bags and cut me off. Now you're doing it on your own. Chicago must be getting cold this time of year.
Welcome back to Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Mr. Hudson. He is producer, singer, songwriter. He's got a brand new album, which is called When the Machine Stops. You've worked with so many great artists, Janelle Monáe, John Legend, Kanye West, Jay-Z. People know your voice if they don't know your name. You know, as a producer, you kind of have to deal with that in the sense that I know your name from 808s and Heartbreak and some of the other big things that you did with Kanye and Jay-Z. And we know your voice from Young Forever and all that kind of stuff. But as an artist, I mean, you are producing for other artists. You are collaborating. It's their track. You might get a feature credit on it, but at the end of the day, you're going into their vision, their song. How do you do that as an artist yourself?
That's a really good question. You've got to find your seat on the bus. Sometimes you're driving, sometimes you're on the back seat being naughty, sometimes you're in the middle, like, handing out the sandwiches. You know, you might be strapped to the roof. You've just got to find where you're meant to be on the bus, and that can take a minute. You know, I remember something Kanye said to me the first time we worked together. Well, he said two things that stuck with me, actually, but the first thing he said was, safe is dangerous. But the one that's relevant to this conversation is he said, you know, he'd flown me all the way from London to Hawaii, and he said, I think the subtext was, I'm not sure why you need to be here, but I want you to be here to help. So that it was almost like, that's what you've got to figure out. And the subtext for me was like, you've got to kind of find where you sit in the studio. When, you know, we went on to make 808s and Heartbreak, and
which is so good. And your contributions to both the tracks and Paranoid and the other tracks, it is groundbreaking music.
You know, it's so interesting. I've always said about not just those records, but that time and a lot of my friends in hip hop, we don't know what we're doing till we've done it. You know, you're in the studio, you're just making a record. And then 6 months later or 10 years later, people say, that was a groundbreaking body of work.
Right.
And you're like, I was just, you know, we were just working. Just, I'm sure Kanye had a grand design and overarching vision, but I was just there trying to, you know, help.
As you evolve as an artist and yourself, you know, with the album that's out now, but just that also as a producer, as the business changes, just being able to peek behind the curtain a little bit and see how albums, great albums, are done. There's so many different people. Like you just said, you're being called in, you don't know what you're going to do, but you're going to be there. How do you navigate that world where it's now become where producers are sending in tracks, and do you like this? Do you not like this? Do you want to try this? It's much different than, say, 15, 20 years ago, where you would sit in a room and try to create together.
Sure. I mean, my first recording session was in 1996, and there was nothing digital involved, so, you know, no phones, no voice memos, no samplers, no digital synthesizers. You know, I mean, not, of course, they existed. They had them for, you know, 10 or 15 years. But we were recording drums and guitars to tape. Everything was microphones, tapes, mixing board, blah, blah, blah. Now, I email an instrumental to someone I will never meet on another part of the planet, and they write over it and then leak it on SoundCloud or whatever before we've done any of the paperwork. You know, it's the wild, wild west. It's fun. I think it's good to be able to work in a really tech way. I reached out to Taylor Bennett I slid into his DMs on Instagram. I mean, there's nothing more 2019 than that, right?
Right, right.
And the next morning he hit me back and he texted me an instrumental at 8:03 LA time, and at 9:04 LA time, I had already sent him a verse that I'd written, recorded, mixed, bounced out of my laptop, and sent it to him an hour and a minute later.
That's crazy.
I mean, that was, I guess that was me just showing, look, this is,
yeah, right.
This is what I can do.
why slide into his DMs? What is it about him or Vic Mensa or Chance or any of the other Chicago artists that
There's
are...
There's a pattern here, isn't there? You know, coming to Chicago this weekend, I was thinking, why is it that... I was kind of asking myself this same question on the plane. Why do I always end up collaborating with people from Chicago? And I think there's something just that I've noticed, which is there's a bravery in terms of talking about emotion from rappers in Chicago. They wear their hearts on their sleeve. My music is interested in emotion lyrically, so they lock in nicely. I think maybe in other parts of the country the emphasis is on swag,
right?
Or on other things. But you know, if you think of 808s and Heartbreak, you think of Vic and Chance and Taylor. They're not afraid to deal with really broad issues and really personal issues as well, political issues and just to, you know, the stuff that matters to them. Right. It's not, I don't want to put any other part of the States down, but I just think that's what's worked for me in Chicago.
For you as a musician, as a producer, you've done many different genres of music. Why do you see yourself gravitating back to hip hop? What is it about?
I don't know. I mean, why does hip hop always work? Why does Phil Collins make sense to the hip hop community and Sting? I think there's something about a really committed emotional vocal from an Englishman that for some reason translates, and I haven't figured that out.
True,
there's a special sauce. I don't know. I still haven't figured that out. I mean, you know, Kanye had a song with Chris Martin from Coldplay about coming back to Chicago.
Yeah, right.
I think it's called Home, wasn't it? Or Home Again.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not just me. There's a really interesting marriage there. It just works.
Yeah.
Oh, shout out Common as well. I mean, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, right?
I haven't worked with him, but we did play basketball together once. And I have to say it's one of the proudest moments of my life when I sank a particularly flamboyant fadeaway jump shot, probably from right under the basket, and he sort of patted me on the shoulder and says, "Hudson, you got game." And I was like, "That's all I needed.
That's all I needed.
I don't need to dunk now."
For you to have the album and to be your work and the first in a decade, do you see yourself moving in that direction? Are you going to be the kind of artist that it's now Mr. Hudson's turn, or are you going to continue to work with other artists and collaborate on their work?
I think both. I don't really make plans anymore. I know a lot of people sort of entrepreneurial and plan it out and say, this is what I'm going to do across five projects or five albums. Good luck to you. If you want a really rigid plan that you won't veer off, you know, you won't go off on a tangent, good luck.
Right.
Have your be the architect of your existence. I just have principles. Try to be a good person. Try to remember to call my mother. Try to eat healthily. Try to be helpful on any project. Go in and... not be like, I'm going to impose what I want to do on you, but just try and figure out what they're looking for. Just go along for the adventure. I'm Sam to your Frodo. That should be on my business card. I don't know where we're going, but it's going to be fun.
That's what you start with when
now
you're in
the
DMs.
Misquoting David Bowie.
You're in the Instagram, you're like, I'm going to be your Sam to your Frodo.
I'm basically, yeah.
That works. Mr. Hudson, longtime producer.
Can I just say it's not as stressful as taking the ring to the fires of Mordor?
Similar though.
It's kind of like just staying in the Shires and making records, but I am Sam Chiffer. I don't know.
That could
am
be
I
the,
Gandalf?
That,
no.
It could be. I like, I mean, you could be Samwise. I guess that could work.
I'm not wise enough to be Gandalf. Maybe I'm Merry and Pippin. I don't know.
We could just keep going. You could be.
We could just
going,
name all these
Name
characters.
All the characters from the
I'm
Lord
an elf.
Of the Rings. That's great. Mr. Hudson in studio. The album is called When the Machine Stops, and it's out now everywhere. Great to have you. Thanks so much for stopping by. We appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jen. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock tonight. 312-981-7200 is the number. Wrap up tonight's show on the road, as we have been doing lately. We've really committed ourselves to getting out into the Chicago neighborhoods to bring you stories of not just the people and the places that are there, but to go to the places and and talk to the people that are there. And that's no different than our next segment, which is really about the anniversary, the 10-year anniversary of Cole's Bar in Logan Square. Logan Square, a gentrifying neighborhood, one that just in the last 10 years has seen it's completely changed. You could think you've been in that neighborhood and blinked your eyes and see a bunch of different restaurants and bars move in. But Coleman Bryce and Cole's Bar has persevered, just celebrated its 10-year anniversary. So we headed up to Milwaukee Avenue to talk about how you keep a dive bar in a gentrifying neighborhood.
Coles is known to many people in many different ways. One, it's a great watering hole right here on Milwaukee Avenue. For an artistic community, both music and comedy, it's known as a home. There's a lot of different, there's the open mic, of course, and bands that come through here. What is Coles to you?
To me, it's, I guess, the iteration of what I would call the perfect bar for me. So a lot of people like to think about where they like to hang out and what's a cool bar and all that stuff. And I have the opportunity to be able to create that myself. And this year in particular, I'm really focusing on trying to make it what I would consider the best bar in the city on all levels.
One of the great things about the bar is it's almost juxtaposition to the neighborhood. As, as more and more bars move in on Milwaukee Avenue, and you will talk about it, but Logan Square is, especially this stretch right here, is changing and changing. A new bar coming in, there's theatricality to it. They're going to suss it up, if
right,
you will.
Right,
and
right.
I'm not putting down the business at all, but this is a great dive bar in the way that, you know, it's almost designed that way. You know, it's less about necessarily what's, you know, the pool table's still here, the linoleum floors are kind of pulling up, but the idea that this is a little bit more of the standard Chicago watering hole that you wouldn't necessarily expect from the new stuff here.
Right, right. And, you know, it's kind of been interesting over the years, and I just kind of realized this year because I heard that Gold Star was closing on Division.
Yep.
And when I was in my early 20s, the type of bars that I would go to would be places like Gold Star and Rainbow, Danny's, Inner Town, and Happy Village. And, you know, I was realizing it when I heard that Gold Star was closing, that it's like a dying breed. And, like, you know, I've tried to kind of model my bar over those kind of experiences that I really loved. And, you know, now 10 years in, I'm like, man, I'm like a link to the past almost.
Well, those bars, I mean, you say those names and they put smiles on my face and Pete's face and, of course, the listener's face. But they are to a bygone era, but they also were all kind of forced out because of gentrification.
Totally.
Or some of those are still standing, but they've changed the way they look. How do you deal with that? In a, you know, you've obviously, this is a 10-year anniversary.
Yeah.
10 years is a millennium when it comes to Logan Square, right?
Yeah,
so how do you deal with the fact that here's Coles right here, you're celebrating your anniversary, but those forces are on display right outside your window?
Yeah. And, you know, that's something that I've been struggling with this year in the last couple years, is just the neighborhood has changed so fast. And there's so many new residents. Prices are going up on everything, all my expenses. But there is a possibility to reach a broader audience, a citywide audience, as opposed to just a neighborhood audience. So that's part of my push this year, is to try and, you know, focus on being the best bar possible. Like, I really want to be the best bar in the city. That's what I tell myself. That's what I'm going for. And B, to try to communicate that to the city as a whole, so that people know I'm here and see what I'm offering.
What makes a great Chicago bar?
I would say good service, good prices, good music, good lighting.
Lighting's always good.
Or bad lighting. I guess actually bad lighting. Right? Bad lighting would make it. Friendly clientele and friendly staff. And that's just about it as far as I'm concerned.
You hit all the marks, yeah. Coles is known for an artistic community. Let's talk about the open mic. The comedy open mic, which you started with Cameron Esposito and other comedians here in Chicago, has become a staple. I mean, to get articles that are written up about the number one open mic in Chicago, that's the high praise when you think about a lot of the open mics that have come and gone in the Chicago area or comedy nights. Why did you start that, and how does it continue 10 years later?
Well, it kind of happened as an accident. I was primarily focused on being a bar that offered live music. And I was looking for entertainment options that would be on weeknights that would not be too loud. I was concerned about neighbors being in the neighborhood and disturbing people and that kind of stuff. And so I wanted to keep it kind of low key. Cameron was the only comedian that I knew, and so I was just very lucky.
Good comedian
there.
Right.
And so I reached out to her, and I said, hey, can we do a comedy thing here? What would you suggest? And so she had the idea of the open mic, and, you know, we just ran with it, and she really made it a huge success. And I've done everything that I can to not screw that up. It's basically what my role in this has been, you know, like from week one, she had a huge crowd of comedians, and we had a good crowd of audience too, and I've just been trying to just nurture that and keep tweaking it and keep it going.
I think it was I think it was Adam Burke who said that, you know, the key to an open mic is that the bar is involved, that they want you there. And that resonates with a lot of comedians and artists and myself. I've been in many bars where it's kind of, well, I don't really want these comedians here. That's Tuesday night, and that's good for business, I guess, but I don't really want. So there is something to the fact you have to be inclusive and you have to be open as an owner to having those kind of experiences.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I should say that Adam came on maybe in week three as a host, so he was very influential in the start of the bar as well. So he had a lot of great pointers for me, along with Cameron. You know, I think for an event like this, you have to be able to see some of the possibility on the revenue side and just from an artistic standpoint in order to get behind it. And I was just really lucky to have these hosts that were able to just crush it, you know, and for to like show me that it's a worthwhile doing. You know, there's other kinds of events like this, trivia night or, you know, music open mic or other kind of poetry night, stuff like that. You know, those things are not huge revenue earners. Now, with the correct host, it might be.
Right.
But, yeah, so they really just killed it from the beginning, and they showed me what the potential was. And like I said, I've just been trying to keep that going, trying to make sure that as they transitioned out and multiple generations of new hosts came on, that we were searching for the hosts that would be able to really execute on that level. And because it really is all about the hosts, especially with the comedy open mic, because they have to save the room like 40 times a night.
Absolutely.
You know?
And Alex and the other hosts that you have now are great.
Sarah Squirm,
You mentioned just, you know, as we get back to the business of running a bar, and we're talking with Coleman Bryce. He's the owner of Cole's, which is celebrating its 10-year anniversary right here on Milwaukee Avenue in Logan Square. But getting back to the idea of running a bar, you mentioned just about the idea of finding something in the midweek that isn't loud because you want to respect neighbors, that you have to sort of think about the community around you. What other challenges and lessons have been learned in 10 years about running a bar in a neighborhood in Logan Square?
For sure. Well, I have been, I guess, lucky to have had to work most of the shifts myself in the first couple years. So when I started out, I worked every day, every shift for the first 6 months, every day of the week. And from there, I've been scaling back as I have family and stuff. But I'm still, you know, bartending three nights a week. And I think that really helps me to be connected with the community. I like people. I like to talk to people. I like to hear people's stories. And, you know, that gives me an opportunity to meet people. And when you meet people, you start joining communities, creating communities, fostering communities, hearing people's stories, hearing what's important to them, meeting your neighbors, and all that good stuff. Yeah.
This is such an interesting moment for this neighborhood. Because you and other bars around have been the, you know, have shepherded in a different time for Logan Square as we know it. And it's also brought in a new community.
Yeah.
And there's some, I saw some census numbers that it's more white than it is Latino now in Logan Square. But as that happens, the community wants to be something else, meaning it's now becoming family friendly. It's now the real estate in this area it rivals Bucktown and other neighborhoods around it. And the bar becomes almost the, even though the bar was what created the community to begin with, it becomes almost the eyesore on the back end, saying we don't want alcohol, we don't want bars or bar culture.
Right.
So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the fact that you're celebrating your 10th anniversary, but there are probably a lot in the community are like, maybe it's enough of bars?
Totally. And I would probably say the same myself as a bar owner here. You know, I don't think we need another bar on the strip. And various bars operate with differing levels of responsibility towards the community. It's a learning process for everybody. And I think, you know, my goal is to be able to sell myself or project myself as a cultural treasure and community meeting place. I think there are bars in neighborhoods like this around the city that have been successful and have had the support of the neighborhood if they're able to communicate the value that they bring to the neighborhood, more than just getting people wasted, more than just being a locus of crime and you know, misdeeds and stuff like that, but really to say, hey, we're a spot for the community. We're a place where you can come and meet with members of the community. We're a place where you can come and experience the culture that the city has to offer. And, you know, I think that's very powerful. Yeah.
10-year anniversary, and that outlasts a lot of bars, especially in burgeoning neighborhoods like Logan Square. Where do you see the next 10 years with you? I mean, you're renting this space, right?
Totally.
I feel like we could see a headline tomorrow that says, new multiplex, you know, huge... I don't even know what the bar would be. Some chain, Chili's chain is coming into Logan Square and Kohl's is out. But what do you see for the future of the bar?
You know, it's really pretty up in the air, I have to say. Having been here for 10 years, I'm starting to think about this a lot more long term. So, you know, when I first opened, it was about let's make it through the year and then let's make it through 2 years. Now we're going to re-sign the lease for 5 years. And so now I'm thinking about 5-year and 10-year possibilities. I just re-signed my lease for another 5 years, so that'll give me a picture of where we're headed and what's happening with the neighborhood. And, you know, I guess there could always be a fancy lawyer that will figure out a way to kick me out, but, you know, it just comes with the territory. And after that, who knows? I mean, maybe this can be something that we can stretch on for another 20 years. Maybe I would move locations. Maybe I will retire and get a job with the city or something. I don't know.
You
know,
a lot
that,
of options.
To me, that sounds sweet. Like, wait, pension, benefits? I don't know. Maybe. That could be
maybe,
cool.
Right. It's just being a Chicagoan and living in the neighborhood and owning a bar, which falls more into the category of a Chicago bar and sort of the tavern, the style here. What does it mean to be a Chicago bar? What differentiates you from a New York bar, from a L.A. bar? What is it to be a Chicago bar?
I feel like it really is a matter of respecting the place and respecting people who are from this place. I think, I don't know, man, it's hard to put, but there's something about Chicago, there's something about Chicago people that you don't find from elsewhere. And when I think about friends who live in different parts of the country, a lot of the populations are very transient. And I feel like people in Chicago have just been here for a long time if they're not a recent immigrant. And there are roots that go back and there's stories that go back and people remember neighborhoods before they changed generations ago. And, you know, I hear my dad talking about Garfield Park in the early 50s and how many different iterations of Garfield Park there have been, how many different iterations of Logan Square, Northwest Side, South Side, West Side. And it's those kind of roots that I think, you know, are important. Yeah.
Coleman Bryce, the owner of Kohl's right here on Milwaukee Avenue in Logan Square, celebrating 10 years. Thanks so much for letting us talk to you at
Thank
the bar.
You guys,
and I see you got the old style tall boy. So Pete and I will imbibe.
Very good. Thank you.
Show tonight, Extension 720. Coming up, John Hansen's going to be here with Saadia Davis. He'll take over at 10 o'clock. 312-981-7200. We're watching a little bit of the All-Star break again in the commercial, and I'm at the point now where I'm like, I don't know any of these players. And I am religious about my fantasy baseball, and I'm like, Alcantara, the Miami Marlins pitcher. I understand that in baseball, I think they still have that thing where there has to be representation for each team. It's stretched now, right? But the White Sox did well tonight. James McCann with a hit and an awesome kind of divey kind of play to end that rally for the NL in the eighth inning.
Yeah.
Another corner of the eye. Jose Abreu up right now. So the AL, the White Sox represent. Giolito came in. Didn't give up anything, so that's good. On the Cubs side, you had Baez and Contreras, and Bryant didn't really do much, did they?
No, I saw Baez and Contreras both 0 for 2. I think both had strikeouts.
Again, we were talking about it. I think the hot take coming out of this is that there are no all-stars left in baseball. There have been a lot of performing well, you know, high-level mediocrity.
Mm-hmm.
from some of the All-Stars where I'm looking at them, and I do follow baseball a lot. It's one of my, I think it's one of my obsessions. Like it's better than drugs and alcohol, right? But this idea that I really kind of zone in on the stats of baseball. I play fantasy baseball with a bunch of friends. So I'm really always in it and paying attention to it. So I see why some of these guys are in the game because, you know, they had good first halves, but they are not your Bryce Harpers or Manny Machado. Both of those guys are not in the NL All-Star game. How is that possible? To think about the guys who are the biggest free agents in baseball history. Neither of them, unless I'm wrong, they might be. I don't pay attention. But I haven't seen either.
Yeah, they must. They must be.
Right? But I don't see, I haven't seen Bryce Harper and I haven't seen Manny Machado in the game. So you think about that. You think about the injured Yankees, both of which, Gio Stanton and Aaron Judge, those guys are the face of the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
There's some other injuries. Jose Ramirez, the third baseman for the Indians, was huge. Huge. And he's had a terrible first half. But the point being that there was a time, if you look at the All-Star roster from last year or the year before, you'll see a lot of, oh, those are, you can bank on that star. You can bank on that star. Boom. Bryce Harper. Bam.
I'm sure, though, I'm sure
they're not there.
If you look back in years past, it's probably been the same thing. They've probably had a, you know, a bunch of stars, and then, you know, Ron Coomer, you know, makes it that one year. You know what I mean?
Maybe, but I feel like, okay, so you're in the bottom of the eighth inning, and I'm just looking at my phone to see who's coming up. This is the NL All-Star team that's coming up in the bottom of the eighth when it counts here. By the way, Jose Abreu grounded into a double play.
Yeah.
JT Realmuto, the catcher for the Phillies. He came over as a big free agent. Mm-hmm. 10 homers, 42 RBIs, 270. I get it. He's a catcher. He's gonna have, but there's catchers. Max Muncy, who is the first baseman, second baseman for the LA Dodgers. He's got 22 homers, hitting 265. A lot of guys doing that. Yasmani Grandal, who was the big guy for the Dodgers for all those years, now on the Brewers, is hitting third this inning. So the NL will bat Realmuto, Muncy, and Grandal. Two catchers. I don't know.
It's a murderer's row.
Yeah. And I'm not sure who they're going to face. They haven't said yet, but Brad Hand... The Indians was on the mind. That's what I'm saying. I'm just not sure. But again, it's based on merit. It's not one of these like the Pro Bowl where you just make it because, or the NBA All-Star game is all about, oh, Dwayne Wade, so flashy. He's not the same Dwayne Wade, but he makes a team. In baseball, I guess you have to earn it.
Well, you do get fan votes.
Yeah.
And that never goes
fans
well.
Fans didn't like Bryce Harper or Manny Machado, huh? There you go.